turn to Luke chapter 16. We began this parable last week. We talked about the parable of the shrewd manager. Last week we looked specifically at the idea of having eternal goals when we're looking at our money, and the idea that we're stewards, that what we have actually is God's, and He's merely allowed us to be stewards of that. So let's read this parable again, and we're going to kind of take two at it and look at what being shrewd means. Luke chapter 16. Jesus told His disciples, "There was a rich man whose manager was accused of wasting his possessions. So He called him in and asked him, 'What is this I hear about you? Give an account of your management, because you can be my manager no longer.' The manager said to himself, 'What shall I do now? My master's taking away my job. I'm not strong enough to dig. I'm ashamed to beg. I know what I'll do, so that when I lose my job here, people will welcome me into their homes.' So he called in each one of his master's debtors. He asked the first, 'How much do you owe my master?' 900 gallons of olive oil, he replied. The manager told him, 'Take your bill, sit down quickly, and make it 450. Then he asked the second, 'And how much do you owe?' 1,000 bushels of wheat, he replied. And he told him, 'Take your bill and make it 800. The master commended the dishonest manager because he acted shrewdly. For the people of this world are more shrewd in dealing with their own kind than are the people of the light. I tell you, use worldly wealth to gain friends for yourself, so that when it's gone, you'll be welcomed into eternal dwellings.'" A lot of people are uncomfortable with this story that Jesus told. Like, how can a society value that type of underhanded shrewdness, right? And today, that's what we're going to talk about, is we're going to address how do we respond to a society that's full of unbelief and doesn't share our values. And we look to the Jesus story here to see what our posture is to be as we respond to an unbelieving society. Now, when a lot of people don't like this story, they're saying, well, I look at it and it doesn't add up. Like, how come Jesus is using a negative example to talk about shrewdness? How come he has this manager who's not being faithful with his resources, and now he's going and changing all his master's bills? And why is Jesus using this negative example? People try and justify that in many different ways. Some of them may or may not hold validity. Some will say, well, when he went to the debtors that owed the master, those were probably bad debts. He probably wasn't going to receive any money off of those, so when he cut it in half, at least he's getting 50 cents off the dollar, right? And we can see that, and that might be the case, but that wasn't his motivation, just to receive debts for his master, because he was fired and he wasn't trying to get his job back. He was simply trying to make friends for himself for the future. Others will say, well, Jews weren't supposed to charge interest to other Jews, and so the master was probably charging interest, and the bill was growing and growing over the years. And so what the manager did was actually just cut off the interest back to the original bill, and the master couldn't do anything about it because legally he wasn't supposed to, and the debtors were now in his favor and were grateful for that. But whatever the case is, we understand that Jesus is talking about a shrewdness here. I want to invite Dwight to come forward. Dwight is going to share a story or two with us about from his years overseas and how shrewdness, some places it's a virtue, other places it's a vice. And Dwight, tell us a little bit, and we'll get this microphone on here for you.
Good morning, church. Well, my wife and I had the privilege of being a part of a different culture and a different language for a number of years in Pakistan, which is part of the Middle East. And I think one of the things that helped me understand a lot of Bible passages better was just learning part of the culture, part of the languages, different things that came alive, like, you know, tearing bread for communion. It was flat bread. You're sharing a meal together. You'd tear off a piece. You'd hand it to someone else. It was a very common way of eating. So when Jesus did that, that was very common. So Bible passages came alive. One such passage was the one that we're looking at today. It's always puzzled me. Why was the dishonest manager commended? What he did was just wrong. It bugged me. But during our study of the Urdu language, we came across this word. It was called chalak. Now, English doesn't have a word with the same connotation. And I found this English translation of the meaning of the word on the internet. So I'll just read out what it said. Dexterous in performing an action so as to escape notice, nimble, skillful, cautious, shrewd, knowing, in a good sense. So the word has a connotation, but it was in a good sense. It wasn't in an evil sense. And I thought, well, that's kind of strange. Another couple of things that came out. Artfully cunning, secretly mischievous, and wily. So if you were in the business world, and you were in Pakistan, and you wanted to be chalak about your business, you would probably try to come up with some sly way of increasing your profit. And I'm going to suggest to you that was what happened to Linda and I. It wasn't ever looked on as a bad thing unless you got caught. If you got caught, well, then, you know, you either weren't very good at business or you hadn't practiced long enough your method of getting your deal done. Anyways, the first experience we had dealing with this was someone who was selling firewood to us. Our first winter when we went up to Murray, which is about 7,000 feet altitude. It's on the same latitude as Florida, but it's 7,000 feet up in the Himalayan mountains. So we had more snow there than we would ever get here. We would get thunder snowstorms. So we needed wood to keep warm all winter. Electricity wasn't reliable, etc. So we had this guy, he showed up with a whole big truckload of firewood, and we were told by other missionaries, you got to watch this guy, he's a little bit tricky. So I was on my guard right from the get-go. I thought, okay, I'm going to watch this guy. But this is basically what his ploy was. He would have a big weigh scale, two great big huge dishes on each side, and it would balance out like this. And he had this weight called a mud. It was about 80 pounds. And he would put that 80 pounds on one side, and then he would be able to weigh 80 pounds worth of firewood. Well, this is where his trick came in. What he did was take 80 pounds of firewood after he'd measured it out. And he said, well, why would we just measure one at a time? This is a big scale. We should be able to do two at a time. So he took the 80 pounds, once it had leveled out, he took that 80 pounds of firewood and put it on this side, so that now we can weigh 2 mun at a time, right? So I thought, sure, why not? We'll do that. So he started weighing out, and he would put 2 mun on there. And my job was simple. All I had to do was sit there and check off, okay, that's one, that's two, that's three. And I was watching him like the hawk because I knew there was something going on here, but I wasn't sure what. Anyways, by the time we got done weighing out, and I must say we probably did 40 or 50 of these, and by the time we got done, I thought, you know what? I could do a double check. That would be a good way to make sure that that mun is still equal to 1 mun. Like, I just moved this back over here. It's all the same. We're all good. Well, I moved it all back, and he didn't want to do it, and I know why now. But somewhere along the way, I got distracted just enough for him to take one of those and fire it off. Okay? So now, every time we weighed, we weren't weighing a full mun. And I don't know how many I actually lost there, but it wasn't proper in that culture for me to call him a cheat to his face. And I didn't see any wood laying on the ground there, so I couldn't say, well, a piece must have fallen off, so what are we going to do about this? There was no real good explanation. So the best thing I could come up with was to say, I think your scale is faulty. And so I had just learned two words in the Urdu language. One was trazu and one was tarbuz. And so what I did is I told him, your tarbuz is kharab, which is basically to say your watermelon is rotten. What I meant to say is your trazu is kharab, which means the scale is not accurate. Anyways, my language teacher had quite a laugh about that, and we eventually ended up settling it this way. I told him, well, what we can do is we can reweigh all that wood 1 mun at a time, or you can give me a discount. And he decided to settle on the latter of the two. In any case, most Westerners, they're considered easy marks over there because we don't even haggle for goods. We usually just pay whatever they ask us the first time. And so usually people are looking at us like we're set up for making a deal anyways. So that's my story.
Thank you, Dwight. Jesus makes a contrast in this story. People of the world and people of the light. If the people of the world are so shrewd in their business just to make a few dollars, as children of the light, belonging to a better kingdom, how can we act? And I love how Dwight didn't just call him a cheat and belittle him as a person. He respected him as a person and says, let's work on a deal here. And he gave him the personal respect, allowed him to save face. And as we're looking at being shrewd, and as we add up all that Jesus has said in this story, he summarizes it himself by saying, be shrewd with your money to make friends for eternity. And in doing so, to me, that tastes a little bit like chicken. Right? And you're like, what? Well, you know, when you try crocodile for the first time, people say, what's it taste like? It tastes like chicken. You try porcupine for the first time, and you're like, what's my reference point? It sort of tastes like chicken. And that's kind of what we do. What is the flavor of how Jesus is instructing us? What does everything come back to? When Jesus says, you have enemies, love them, pray for them. When there's poor people, help them. When the government soldiers from this pagan, terrible nation government are forcing you to carry their bags for a mile, go an extra mile, go 2 miles. When the tax collectors are being scam artists, enjoy a meal with them. Invite them over, and that kind of sums it all up. You head over to Superstore, buy a roasted chicken that's already warm, and invite people over. The common theme that Jesus keeps hitting again and again and again is love. So when he tells us, make friends with your money, the whole thing tastes like love to me. So it's not just tastes like love, it tastes like chicken, because the love has expressed itself through inviting people into your life, through hospitality, right? And hospitality is opening up your heart, it's opening up your home, it's inviting people in your life, it's sharing food with them. And so when Jesus is saying, be shrewd in making friends with your money, to me, that just tastes like chicken. It tastes like hospitality. So are you tracking with me on that? So shrewdness, I know it's supposed to be some mastermind plan, this super complex, difficult to initiate, tough to understand. But what if shrewdness is as simple as just taking the resources that you've been entrusted with as a steward, using them to fulfill your master's purposes, and it's just as easy as going down to Superstore, buying a chicken that's already baked for you, and inviting people over and saying, come, join me in my life. I'm going to open up my heart to you. And then watch and see how the Spirit leads. That's acting with foresight. That is shrewdness. So Jesus, his main point, he says, make friends. And we make friends in a world of unbelief. Because where are we going to find friends? In the world around us, in the culture around us, whether they're that shrewd businessman in Pakistan or someone here, in a world of unbelief is where to make friends. Now, of course, we live in a post-Christian era, right? Christendom survived for centuries, is now coming to an end, and the church is no longer in favor with society around us. We could share many examples, but we all know that the church doesn't have that standing in society that it used to, and now we're often looked down upon, and we're in a world of unbelief. So how do we respond? How do we make friends in a world of unbelief? We're called to be shrewd. Now, I read a book this week. Sometimes when you read a book, it's some new concepts, and you're like, oh, I want to explore that more, and I hadn't really thought about that before. And other books, we read it, and it's like, the author just took all my brains and put it on paper. But they said it way better than I could have. And so I was all ready for this message, and then I read this short book by Matt Chandler called Take Heart. And he said everything way better than I could ever say it, and he added in a few extra things, and I thought, I love it. So I recommend this book to you, Take Heart by Matt Chandler. It's how to respond with courage in an unbelieving world. And so some of my thoughts are coming from that, and I encourage you to read that book. But what I'm doing here is I want us to see, how do we respond to the culture around us? Now, he says in the book that one of the ways that we respond is just to simply consume culture. To consume culture is say, well, the world is like that. I'll just take part in that. I'll become like that. I'll blend in with the world. And soon we've got our faith, but it's all mixed in with the culture around us. This is something that week after week after week, we're going to God's Word and we're reminding ourselves, no, we aren't simply consumers of culture. We're distinct people. We're different people. And Jesus even says it here in this parable. He's contrasting the people of the world and the people of the light. He's saying, you are people of the light. Remember your identity. You're a child of God. You belong to Him. And one of the best ways for us to not love the things of the world, love the world or the things of the world, is to maintain our identity as children of light. To remember whose we belong to and who we are because of what Jesus has done for us. So if one approach is to consume culture, another approach is to condemn culture. To look at culture around us and say, that's all wrong and I want to avoid that, so I'm going to live over here apart from culture. I push culture aside and I say, I'm going to isolate myself, I'm going to put myself with like-minded people, and I'm going to create my own little mini community over here. It can seem like a good idea, except it's not keeping up with our master's purposes. And as we looked last week, we're stewards, and a steward needs to know what is his master's purpose in order to use what's entrusted us with, he's entrusted us with. And in this passage, we see, yes, we're stewards, and our master's purpose for us to make friends. If we simply condemn culture and write it off and say, let's huddle together by ourselves, how can we go and make friends? We need, as Jesus calls us in John 17, when Jesus prays, he says, I don't pray, God, that you just snatch them out of the world, but that you send them into the world. So that we're rubbing shoulders with people. We're part of the world, but in that, of course, we need our protection to maintain our identity and our uniqueness. Another approach is to convert culture. To say, look at what culture has done, and not simply take the Great Commission and say we want people to come to know Jesus, but our culture as a whole, to work on the legislation and the policies and to bring back our Christian nation. And that's another approach, is let's go protest and bring back our Christian values and our Christian standards in the culture around us. Two warnings when it comes to converting culture. One is there will always be an overwhelming temptation to compromise when we go to convert culture. What I mean with that is we'll align ourselves with other people because a common enemy creates strange allegiances. All of a sudden we're gathering together with people that believe completely different than us and say, let's battle this part of culture together. So we want to be wary of that, what type of compromise we make. And another warning when we go to convert culture is it's easy to lose sight of what they call the city of God and the city of man. Augustine wrote about this 1,500 years ago. He says, the city of man is this world and all that's happening here, but we belong to another city, the city of God. Our identity is there. He's our king. We're part of his kingdom and his realm. And it's easy to lose sight of that and to say, if we want to change parts of our culture, it's easy for us to say, we just want to regain Christendom. Or at least the parts of it that we like. We want to be a Christian nation again. Except the fact of the matter was, we were never a Christian nation. We had a mirage of it. There were lots of things in place that looked like that. But we never had a Christian nation. And so, for those few times when the church does gather together to say, let's work together towards legislative change, what should our approach be? How do we go about doing that? First of all, it needs to taste like chicken. In other words, we need to remember the goal is people and loving the people and making friends with them, not simply an ideology. And so that has to be the flavor of it all. And to do that, I love the yes, no, yes approach, where you say, yes, I hear what you're saying. No, I don't necessarily agree. Yes, here's a better yes, a better alternative. So when we say, yes, I hear what you're saying, we remember that in all of our conversations when we're talking about culture and the degrade of society today and I can't believe teenagers these days, and in all of those types of conversations of the government's doing this and schools are doing that, we need to remember that if people from that crowd were listening to our conversation, would they be able to say, yes, you're fairly and accurately representing our values and our beliefs? Are we able to say to them, yes, I hear what you've said, I hear what you're saying, these are your values, here's where you're at, and they'd say, yes, you understand that. They're giving them a fair hearing. And that takes a lot of hard work, but it's worth it on so many levels. So we start with, yes, I hear what they're saying, and then we can move into a, no, I don't necessarily agree with all of your conclusions and how you're moving there. And in fact, Oftentimes, when people will talk and say, here's what we're supporting, and they're holding up some values, they have some underlying values that they don't speak so much about that are really the ones that say, that's what we have a concern with. And so we can bring those to attention and show the peripheral areas that we have concern with. But we need to provide a better yes. It's easy to be people who critique and say, that's wrong. But as followers of Jesus, Jesus has given us a better yes. And he's given us a better yes because as we properly diagnose the problem, we can have the real cure, can't we? But if we misdiagnose the problem and simply say that one act of legislation is the problem, all we have to do is battle that act of legislation and then we'll live happily ever after in a good Christian nation again. No, it doesn't usually work that way. We want to diagnose the problem and say, what's at the root of it? And the root of it will always be the sinful heart of man, taking God off his throne, elevating us. And as we see the real problem, then what's the solution? It will always come to the cross of Jesus. It will always come to his forgiveness and his grace extended on the cross. Jesus will always be the answer. So our primary posture as a church isn't to go and convert culture and to change them, but rather because we know that our focus is on God's eternal city, not just on now. And so, with our focus being on God's eternal city, we spend time as a church with people, making friends, inviting them into our lives, and that's where real deep change happens. Inviting people into our lives and walking with them. Look how Jesus lived, right? Jesus, he shrewdly secured our eternity, and he brought us to be his church. Here, Jesus, he's coming from a position of privilege and strength in heaven. He has all the power, all the glories of heaven, and he empties himself. He humbles himself and takes on the form of a man. He begins in the manger. He moves into the woodshed as a carpenter, and then he moves out as a teacher. And all of this is God's big story of how he's dealing with sin. Jesus coming in humility. He's not drawing attention to himself. He didn't really make any changes in the government. He didn't make any huge noticeable impact on society. The courts didn't really take notice of Jesus. When he opposed people, he wasn't opposing a pagan government that's going against God's morals. He's opposing the religious elite that are leading people astray. And here's Jesus. And in all of this, when the crowds start to gather around, he'd go to secluded places. He'd heal people and not advertise it. And then what's his big move? Jesus' biggest move was the cross. What we say? Like, this just seems crazy. Here's God with all his power. He can make all these changes. He can wipe out the Roman army. He can bring in a Christian nation. And what does Jesus do? He goes to the cross. And to us, from our vantage point, it seems ridiculous. How could Jesus just throw himself right into death? How could he do that? Like, what kind of love is that? It just seems haphazard. And yet, from God's perspective, it was his eternal plan. That was God's way of dealing with sin, to send his own son to become sin for us, so that he could take our sin and we could take his righteousness. That was God's plan. And if that is a definition of shrewd, I think that would be it. Acting with foresight. Planning ahead for the future, having this way that seems where the devil's like, yes, I've crucified the Son of God, and God says, surprise, I've taken that death to bring about life for all people. And then what type of church did Jesus secure for himself? Throughout a large part of history, the church is weak, and he is strong. The church isn't the educated people, but Jesus is the wisdom and gives his spirit to guide and to teach. And often the church is on the margins of society. And it's on the margins of society that the church thrives. When the church becomes the prominent culture and all of the government is supporting the values and the morals of the church, typically we just see nominalism. Typically we just see people just kind of going along with the norm. But when the church is on the edge of society, that's where it thrives. We look at countries like Iran and China where the church is thriving, and yet it's being persecuted. We look at the first 300 and some years of the Christian church where there was hard persecution. Everything was coming against them, and yet it thrived. When the church is on the margins of society, it thrives, because as the church is made for the humble and the weak and the despised and the outcast, this is who Jesus has gathered around him. And then this is the church where Jesus says, and now act shrewdly. Go and make money. Go and use your money to make friends for eternal purposes. As we open our hearts and homes to people, it actually becomes costly, right? Sometimes we look at some radical Christians, and they can go out and they can knock on doors and hand out brochures talking about Jesus and say, whoa, that was a big risk that they take. I could never do that. But do you know what's more difficult and risky than that? Inviting someone into your life. Allowing them to be part of your life. Because people are messy. People have problems. Their relationships are complex. And inviting someone into your life to be generous and to care for them is costly. And because it's costly, Jesus talks about our money. He says, be shrewd with that money. Be shrewd with that money, but too often, we don't have very much money left over at the end of the month to be shrewd with. Even though we're amongst the richest people on the entire planet, often we don't have any spare money. And so I think it's time for us to talk about budgeting a little bit. And you're like, really? The pastor's going to tell me to budget? Okay, I don't want to see your budget. I'm not even going to tell you what to put in your budget. Except for keep eternal goals in mind, right? If we don't budget, we make all this money, more than most people in the entire world. We have so much money, and yet we just spend it all. And then we go into debt. And what does debt do? It holds you back. Debt, in fact, makes it so that you're always working backwards, trying to catch up. Debt is frustrating. Debt is defeating. Debt doesn't let you take risks. Debt doesn't let you be shrewd. It ensnares you and enslaves you. But if you can work on a budget and figure out how much money you have and how much money you're spending, how to save some for a rainy day and some for holidays next year, and some where you set aside the first fruits and not just the leftovers to give and to be generous with, it's actually energizing and it's freeing and it's invigorating, because you're like, I have a little bit to play with here and I can go and be generous. It's planning ahead. That's being shrewd. Now, some of you are like, yeah, I tried a budget once and it didn't work. Part of the thing about budgeting is you got to keep on trying. And there are people in this church that are very good in this department, and I've spoken with them and they said, yes, we're willing to help people work out a budget and how to do that. And so if you're in that category where you're like, I need some help here, I need some advice, there are people available. And there's always ways you can communicate with the church. You can email in, you can make a phone call, the connect cards, you can put it in the box out in the back or in the offering plate. You can always talk to me or one of the leaders. We're always available to help. And of course, this is confidential. So just throwing that out there. And even this evening, Advisors with a Purpose, they're having a meeting and they're going to talk about your estate. So let's just say you pass away and you want to leave all your money to your kids and you have $1 million after your house and everything else. The government's probably going to snatch about $300,000 of that. And so your kids are only going to get $700,000, right? But Advisors with a Purpose is going to be able to connect you with some people to help give you advice and say, well, if you give to some charities, you give to your church, give $300,000 away, the government will get zero, and your kids still get the same amount. Makes sense, doesn't it? Be shrewd with your money. Come to that meeting tonight and find out more. There are a lot of things that are barriers for us being shrewd. Fear is a big one. Being just plain old lethargic and not getting up off the couch. Self-centeredness stops shrewdness. Just not having a plan. But let's not let money stop us. And even if you barely have any money, what if you take the little bit that you have? And as Jesus says here, right in this passage, whoever can be trusted with little can be trusted with much. How can you be shrewd with your nickels and dimes and quarters, right? How can you be shrewd with just a little to be generous, to make friends for eternity? Now, the main help for all of these barriers that stop shrewdness is Christian community. If you have fear, get together in community, and that'll help with your fear. You can be with others. If you're just lethargic and it's hard to get going, community will help come along and give you a boost. If self-centeredness, community will help. You don't have a plan? That's why we gather in community, to talk and to brainstorm and to get other ideas. So this sentence here on the screen behind me, it says, be a community set on Jesus' eternal goal, strategically making friends through generous hospitality. That's really my heartbeat for us as a church. As a church, it's not just here we are Sunday morning, but really who we are as a church are the smaller groups that gather throughout the week, whether formally or informally, where you're a community of believers because we're a family of believers. If all you have is Sunday morning, you're missing out on so much. But as you're involved in other people's lives and they're with you and you're walking together, that's who Jesus has made us to be. And that community is to be set on Jesus' eternal goals. Not just to follow him as a model, although he is a model, but to see he is our life. All that we are, all that we have comes from who Jesus is and what he's all about. And so with Jesus, and we know his goals, and so as a community, we are always aligning ourselves. What are his goals? What's he all about? And then we can say, okay, let's be strategic here. How can we make a plan? How can we just sit together and brainstorm and say, what do we have? What's available to us? So that we can make friends. We can be an impact on society. We can do that through generous hospitality. A few ways to do that. When you're talking together with your friends, you're chatting about Jesus' goals and focus, take an inventory. Say, what is it that we have available? You have that personality, and that's super beneficial. You have these talents and gifts, and that's super beneficial. You have these financial resources and time. That's good. Well, let's take an inventory of what we have available to us and realize, okay, if God has entrusted with us with these resources, how can we be faithful with that? And not only here's our resources, but what opportunities are available? Who do you know? Oh, I know the same person. Maybe we can make friends with them and invite them over. What other opportunities and contacts do you have? Those are important conversations to have with your community. And not just sit around and talk about it, but make dinner a priority. And making dinner a priority, it involves a lot of mess. Not just then people come and they mess up your dishes, but you're part of people's lives. You're hearing their stories. You're crying with them as you hear their hardships, and you're walking with them through their challenges. It's so rewarding, but it's so messy. It's risky. But as we make dinner a priority, it's an amazing thing. You can invite neighbors over, but together with your community of people, sometimes it's like, I can invite people over, but I'm not very good at talking to them. And after they go home at night, I think of all the things I could have said. But when you're together with a community of believers and you all have the same goal of we're making friends with eternal purposes to love people, that's a beautiful thing. And then finally, love the outsider. And Jesus spoke and he says it's easy to invite people over that'll invite you back, but what about inviting people over that can't repay? Will we be a church that says we care well for the single parents? Will we be a church that says we care well for people of other cultures that may not feel like they belong and fit in here? Will we be a church that cares for people who are vulnerable and oppressed and feel like they're ostracized by society? We can welcome them in and say, here's a place for you to belong. Love the outsider. We'll be speaking more about that in upcoming parables in the following months. And Jesus continually speaks about areas of social justice and change in our society. And as we go in and we say, how can we care for the needy? How can we care for people who are lonely? And youth, this is an important one for you. Because it's often easy to see, here's the person that has no friends and on the outside, and often for very good reasons, and I'm not comfortable hanging out with them. Imagine if the church adopted them and said, we will love you and care for you. What a powerful way to see society changed. We be shrewd by responding to the culture around us, and we do that with the whole taste of love, by inviting people into our lives, which is all about hospitality, opening our hearts and opening our homes. And to me, that tastes like chicken. So I want to encourage you, go and buy a chicken this week. Invite someone around, right? Easy to do. I can't remember how much they cost, but they're not very much. Get a chicken and invite people around. Who can you invite others? Bring some followers of Jesus in. Bring others in. And we're a church that isn't just friendly and that we put on our smiles when we show up Sunday morning, but we're loving. And we're looking ahead with foresight to be loving. So this book by Matt Chandler ends by saying, I don't know if you ever got to go to work with your dad when you were a kid. Maybe he gave you a bit of work to do while you were there, and you were thinking, wow, this is important stuff, grown-up stuff. I don't really even know what it is, but it's exciting and it's very serious. That's a cool day when you're a kid. Well, hospitality is God's work, and your Heavenly Father wants you to come to work with Him. God says, hey, I'm saving some folks in your area. You want to come and do some eternal work with me? And you say, yeah, great. Thanks, Father. What do you want me to do? Well, for starters, see those folks in your neighborhood who think Christians are narrow-minded, irrelevant jerks? And see that family who doesn't really just fit in for whatever reason? I want you to invite them around. Eat dinner with them. Engage with them and listen to them and love them. Dinner? With them? That's what you want me to do? Yeah. Will you help me? Behold, I am with you always to the end of the age, Jesus says. Let's pray together. God, thank you that you sent Jesus to open up his heart to us, to invite us into his life. I pray we can do the same for others. Give us the courage this week to invite people into our lives, to love people that aren't normally loved by others, that as a church we can act with foresight, we can be shrewd by making friends and inviting people in. Give us the strength to do that. In Jesus' name, amen.